All right, this is talking with Harold Weaver at Berkeley on 7th June, 74. Now, you began as an optical astronomer, really.
Yes, and optical astronomy in a very specific sort. It was optical astronomy of largely of the galaxy. It had gotten into the problem of star clusters and ages and such things, early stages of the discussions of ages.
Mm-hmm.
But what my real interest in was the galaxy and understanding it. And when radio astronomy, well, I guess to start a bit earlier, I had been very much taken by the results of radio astronomy in 1950-51. That was the first, 1951 was the first real indication of spiral structure. I still remember very well attending the IAU meetings in Rome in 51, seeing the first presentations of the of the hydrogen spiral structure and being terribly impressed by it. And in those days, one traveled by boat rather than by airplane, and I dreamed about the problems of connecting up the stars with the gas all the way home, and wrote a couple of papers on it almost immediately when I got home.
I see.
Treating the stars as a star gas, for example, and using some of the same techniques that have been used by the radio astronomers, primarily Oort and van de Hulst. And
using a Kinnick model of the galaxy and,
yes,
and so forth.
Yes, it was really to derive, in fact, their publications of that, showing the, in 10 degree sectors, as I recall, showing the velocity distributions of OB stars, and the velocity distribution of OB stars looked like the profiles of the hydrogen lines. And then I
haven't seen these. Where was this published?
In the Astronomical Journal.
I
derived spiral arms on the basis of these, or showed at least that they were internally consistent on a broad scale. The gas arms and the star arms were quite similar. You could not explain the observations of the stars on the basis of anything like a uniform distribution of stars. You had to have streaks in the galaxy that were like the spiral.
And was the higher inclination of the optical features already apparent at that point?
Yes, it had become apparent, because 1951 was also the year that Morgan and company showed the first diagram at the American Astronomical Society meetings and indicated the higher inclination of the arms.
That's a funny coincidence, to me anyway, that 51 was the year that spiral structure became apparent.
The year of spiral structure. It was fantastic.
Both optically and radio.
And in spite of all the years before that, when everybody was struggling and using the same techniques, or thinking of the same techniques, it was really before that that Bada had pointed out the stringiness of the early type stars, the fact that they define the arms in a galaxy, and so it was clear that we had to look to those objects in our own galaxy.
But let me ask, there was no doubt that we were in a spiral galaxy.
Oh, no, no, never.
Before 1950.
No.
It's just a matter of what were the arms, actually.
Where were the arms, and the reason that they were so hard to find was that people were using techniques that were the hoot. In fact, that was what started all the star counting problems, and people thought, many people thought that the arms would be detected by getting star counts, making density analyses
of all kinds of stars,
etc. Then it became apparent you had to do it in the early type stars, the young stars, if you wanted to find anything. And then there were many different solutions after that that pointed it in. The hydrogen, of course, was a unique thrust, because nobody knew anything about the hydrogen much before then. First looked at it only a short while before.
Right. Okay, so then you tried to tie them together, and then what was the next thing?
Well, see, then I had been working in galactic astronomy, Trumper and Weaver was already published by then, and so I had been in that field. My thesis was in that field, actually. And I realized that if I'm going to continue in galactic astronomy, which is what I wanted to do, I obviously had to start doing some radio astronomy. One could not do galactic work without radio astronomy. That was an absolute must. So I did some thinking about it and work in it, and we we got some things going at Berkeley. Struve was here as the chairman of the department at that time. He was very much interested in these new things, very much alive to all of the potential of radio astronomy.
Well, can you say a little bit about that? Unfortunately, of course, I can't talk to him. And he later became director of NREO for a while, and he wrote a review in Sky and Telescope as early as 48 about radio astronomy. So he obviously had a very great interest.
Oh, he was very much interested. You see, he had gotten involved really through knowing Grote Reber.
Oh, because that's right, because Grote, he was at Chicago.
Grote was in the Illinois area.
I mean, he was the editor of APJ when...
He was the editor of the APJ, there were a whole sequence of things of this kind that had gotten him involved. And Reber, by that time, was giving some papers in meetings and so on. I remember hearing in various Astronomical Society meetings papers by Grote Reber, and a few people were paying attention to it. There was some interest, but certainly not what it deserved. It was a forgotten topic.
But what was it about these people, and in particular Otto Struve? Was it just an open-mindedness? Or?
Oh yes, I think an open-mindedness and an awareness of the things going on in astronomy, and finally the clear realization that here was something, a new field that people had to understand and had to bring into the mainstream of astronomy. I think that his becoming director was a different affair completely. That was a different affair, but certainly in his as director of Greenbank.
Yeah.
But certainly his awareness and interest was what pushed him on to favor the development of radio astronomy here at Berkeley. So at that time, I don't remember the year, but it must have been 52 or quite early thereafter. Ron Bracewell came as visiting professor one year from Australia and introduced radio astronomy.
In what sense?
Fossey and Bracewell had just been written and so on. And Ron gave a course here at Berkeley and interested some students in it. And we decided that radio astronomy certainly had to be a part of the Berkeley scene. And
specifically, do you remember which students it? Where that took that time?
Yes, well, there were several. Let's see, some who, one, there's one fellow who is now at Los Alamos, and George, you know, magnetic stars at
Bethany?
No. George, not Horace. Big, tall fellow, worked on our library for variables for his thesis. I can't call his last name. Do you know who I mean?
Well, I'm not quite placed.
He was on the staff at Lick and then transferred to Caltech, and he works on on magnetic stars. George, I keep thinking Perkins, but that's not right. He worked on a problem with Ron Bracewell in the reflection of the galaxy, of radio radiation from the galaxy, from the solar corona, and the fact that one should get changes that depend upon where the galactic center is and how it...
Jeez, I never heard of that problem.
So it was an interesting... a lot of things started. Well, then a committee at that time was appointed by the chancellor of the university to consider the problem of formally establishing radio astronomy as part of the Berkeley campus. I was the chairman of that committee, and Sam Silver was a member, Louis Alvarez was a member, and it seemed to me there may have been another one or so, but we investigated the problem at quite some length and decided it obviously was something that needed to be done. Sam Silver was particularly involved and had planned himself to start a small radio thing through electrical engineering.
He was in that department here.
Yes, yeah. He was in electrical engineering. And
what time was this? What year was this now?
I'd have to look up the exact things, but it must have been 52 or 53, somewhere around there. I have all those papers sticking around somewhere. We can look them up if you're really interested. And, we wrote a report, and astronomy was agreed to, at first I thought that it should be solar radio astronomy. And we had some problems actually. Ron Bracewell, as I remember, Ron Bracewell was invited to come and then some reason didn't. And we were having problems starting radio astronomy, so finally Struve asked if I wouldn't take over the problem of radio astronomy, because I was vitally interested and felt that we had to do things in a way. And I finally agreed to it, provided I could do the radio astronomy that I felt was most important for the galaxy.
And but who was doing it before you? Who was in charge?
There wasn't anyone, you see. We didn't.
You had the committee. You
had the committee, and the university had agreed that it should be established. And Clark Kerr, who then was chancellor and became president, was very much in favor of it and agreed to provide university funds and provide we could find matching funds from the outside. And so finally we... Well, I agreed to become the director and to head the project, provided it could be galactic radio astronomy, that's how it all started. And then we established, managed to. Oh, there was lots of problems to get the money. We didn't get financial backing right away. It was a long pounding of the pavement in Washington to raise the money, and finally through the Navy, when Sputnik went up. They got a lot of money, and they immediately funded this project, and we started the telescope at Hat Creek. But we've been at it for some time then, in locating sites and testing sites.
So you had already known that you wanted to go to Hat Creek?
No, we, as I remember, it came a little later than that, but we'd already started a lot of the activity.
So what was your first goal to do at Hat Creek?
To do hydrogen, though we also in the first series of receivers had a 3-centimeter receiver, so we started some continuum work in 3 centimeters.
But now the first observations actually were somewhat later.
It took us...
I talked to David Williams.
Yeah, it took us some time to get things going and to... it wasn't an instantaneous affair. We were several years in getting the observatory.
And that, really, that was, you got the money in 58, and the first observations were when?
I don't remember the first observations. I'd have to look that up in the little notebook.
Just outline what some of the main problems were?
In getting started after?
Or maybe not as problems, but what the steps were that you had to go through.
Well, there were long... I would like to say one other thing before I do that, and that's in the why I felt a pressure to do radio astronomy of the galaxy, and why I felt agreeable to doing that finally. I felt really pushed to do it. I felt it was imperative to do it. Bart Bock, who was a very long-standing friend from the time I had been a graduate student, Bart Bock had been doing radio astronomy at Harvard. I had seen that in progress, in fact the very earliest things on the 28-foot antenna. I had taught summer session there one year and saw that. And then when it became clear that Bart was going to Australia as the director of the institution there, I felt that we had to, and it looked as though radio astronomy would die at Harvard. I thought it was multiply important for us to do it here, and that was why I really was anxious to finally to do the radio astronomy here.
Do you think that's fair to say that it did die down for a while after you left?
It did die down for a while. It did indeed, and it certainly had a rebirth there. But following Bart's removal, it was. It was at a somewhat low ebb.
The rebirth you're talking about is, I suppose, the recombination lines, Zuckerman.
Well, even before that, it had been going before that. Tommy Gold had been interested and was doing radio charge radio astronomy. They had the 60-footer at the Agassiz station. And so it had had a somewhat of a rebirth. But it had its great start that it has now, even after that, after Ed Lilly came and so on.
Well, Bart Bock is another person, of course, I guess, who sort of parallel to your interest, an optical astronomer, interest in galactic structure.
That's right. And that's why we were such close friends and always have been. And his entry into radio astronomy made it clear that there was a great field, the things that turned out at Harvard. And certainly Harvard produced all of the important young radio astronomers at one time. That was
the source
of American radio astronomy. And I think that the community owes an enormous debt to Marvin and to Harvard for what it did.
Yeah, it's rather amazing when you look back at the names that came out in two or three years.
Well, I got a great insight. I went and spent a year there then, finally, at about the same time we had to put all the dates together. But there and at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, the DTM, and I had a sabbatical from here, and I spent the time between these two places in the field of radio astronomy, and that was my first sort of dirtying my hands with what went on.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came back here and built this one.
So, okay, so we got off on a diversion.
Yeah.
What were some of the
steps? You were asking
steps,
some of the steps that led up to it. Well, the usual, for a while, run around with all committees and administration here on the Berkeley campus. That took quite a while. Though the president, the chancellor and president were for it, had to overcome the problems of the business manager here who was worried about finances, and then there was the academic planning committee, and there we had a problem because the question was, should it be combined with electrical engineering or shouldn't it? And there were lots of internal squabbles, and finally it became a separate institution. That is, it's the laboratory, has its own budget.
Right.
It is, however, directly attached to and with and is a part of astronomy in a very real sense, and there's a very close cooperation.
Which is something I'm sure that you wanted to...
Oh, that's what I always wanted.
That's
exactly what it was supposed to be. I'm sorry that electrical engineering was not in it more closely. That was sort of ruled out by the academic planning committee, and they felt that engineering was not a part of this, and therefore they did not favor a closer bond with engineering, though I had felt at first that it should have a very close bond with engineering.
So there were these administrative
A lot of administrative hang-ups, which we finally overcame, and then...
Were there technical ones?
No, there weren't any really bad technical ones. We were quite fortunate. We finally hit upon the plan, even though we had started the 85-foot, at least it had started in the sense that it was ordered. We had a terrible hang-up on that with Blau Knox and other possible suppliers, and we were rather a long time in getting a contract written, again because of the nastiness of administration here and all the boilerplate that they demand in the contracts,
mm-hmm.
and finally the reluctance of Blau Knox to agree to some of the specifications, and so it was a long hiatus and an argument, series of arguments here, and finally the dish was produced at Philco, and that was their entry into that particular type of things in dishes. So we got a very good price, and I think it was practically a free dish. They lost money, I'm sure. And it's been a very satisfactory dish in lots of ways. However, we had planned to do a good deal of it ourselves, for example, the control system and all that, to save money, and we were always operating the damn thing on a shoestring. We were going to do the controls, and we had quite an engineering group here at that time, a whole room full of engineers and so on. And we decided, as experience, we better build a small antenna and operate it for a while this was going on. So we built the 33-foot, which you may have seen lying around there, and that first thesis was done on that, or maybe a couple of them.
Who's?
One was Kimball Hansen, who's now at the University of Utah. That he had a thesis that was done with that one, and some other student work was done with that. But the important feature of that was that we tried out the control system, and we learned what not to build.
Right.
It was an automated telescope, in a sense, in that you just cranked in the positions you wanted, and the telescope was then automatically slewed over to the right place with the appropriate decelerations, etc., etc. But at that stage of the game, it was too complicated, and we had a great deal of trouble with the system. It was too delicate, too complicated, too many relays, everything was built with relays in those days. The thing was a mass of relays, which were always burning up. And so it was a godsend that we built the system, tried it on a telescope, found it was a good system, but it didn't work in the sense that it wasn't reliable enough. So we made an absolute change in the about face in the plans for the 85 foot. It was then a very simple system, hand setting and all that sort of thing for a long, long time. And it didn't become automated until computers became easy to get and cheap, etc. And then it was automated with a computer. But we didn't foresee automation at that early stage, and it would have been a mistake if we had installed as much of an automatic system as we had originally planned. So it was a great aid that we built the little one. It was worth all that it cost, and it wasn't very expensive. I think it wasn't much more than probably $40,000 for the whole thing. Maybe a bit if we count hidden costs and salaries that go on anyway and so on.
What was the cost of the 85?
Well, my recollection is that it was something like $280,000 or so, plus our own work. And again, I have to look that up, but it was a very inexpensive telescope.
But now, okay, it got rolling in sometime around 64 or something, but it was quite a while before you got to do your galactic structure observations.
Yes, well, we started that. Well, there were a whole series of things. There were some student work was in progress on it. That's always been a part of that equipment. Dave Williams and I did a hydrogen survey with an old single channel scanner. And we did a first picture of the galaxy, actually, but it was I was so unhappy that it didn't do a lot more that we never published it. It was just here. And then we tried some other things, and we got involved with the OH. And the OH maser was a long-standing, that was a long hiatus where that interrupted things. So
that was really just a sidetrack.
That was a sidetrack. See, we discovered that the OH maser was discovered there at Hat Creek. It was on a program that I had started, and it was discovered quite independently at Harvard and Hat Creek, even to the extent that it was seen in the same objects. And we happened to publish first here, and I think that caused at one time quite a bit of hard feelings with the group at Harvard. But it was absolutely independent, and there was not even any
knowledge. You didn't even know about theirs before you sent in your publication?
Not a single thing was known. In fact, what I was interested in was the absorption lines. I was looking at absorption lines, and there came the emission at one time, and that's how we discovered it, quite accidentally, while working on a different problem.
What about the time variations?
Well, that we discovered here. And you see, after that, there were three of us who worked on it quite together, and it was a very close association between David Williams and Nan Dieter and myself. We worked on this one problem. It was the topic of every lunch, etc. Minkowski suggested some of the objects we looked at after we had begun to find this emission, and then immediately questioned, what sort of objects is it? And we would all discuss it, you know, every lunch, what to look at next. Quickly run it down, the time variation came up. I guess just came up from the discovering it by comparing different observations of the same object. And Nan Dieter then is the one who worked specifically on that sort of everyone took it and particular sort of thing. And David worked on polarization, and Nan worked on time variation, and I worked on some of the other aspects of it, and sort of.
Weaver then said that time variations were definitely discovered at Berkeley, and polarization at Harvard, and the OH emission itself was independently at both places. This ends the interview with Harold Weaver on 7 June 1974, and it's the end of this tape also.